Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this, the third in a series of European lectures. We're now halfway through the British presidency, though I think if you looked around in the press, you wouldn't notice much about it. LSE, however, is undeterred, and we're going to try to keep alive the idea of Europe's future and consider ways in which it's going forward. And we're delighted that Madame Christine Lagarde has agreed to speak to us this evening on Europe and the World Trade Round, Seizing the Opportunity for Growth and Development. Did you know you were saying that? Madame Lagarde was appointed ministre déléguée for foreign trade in the new French government that was formed following a certain referendum that you might have heard about earlier this year. So she's been in post since June. She's a distinguished lawyer and a highly successful businesswoman who's blasted her way, I think, through the glass ceiling, if there was one in the legal profession. And she has been awarded the honour of being a Chevalier of the Légion d'Honneur. Christine Lagarde was, as I indicated, chairman of Baker and McKenzie's Global Policy Committee, which I think means that you were the boss. Is that correct? And therefore very much in charge of an international legal firm, having previously been in the executive committee for many years. World trade negotiations, which is what a minister for trade tends to get involved in, if you think about it, call for being able to hold your breath for prolonged periods, but also for knowing when to move together towards common solutions. So it's perhaps reassuring that Madame Lagarde was once a member of the French national synchronized swimming team. But staying with the sporting metaphor, I ought to point out to Madame Lagarde that there's a favorite national sport in the UK, and that's being critical of Peter Mandelson. So feel free. Madame la Ministre, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Can you all hear me well? Good. Well, first of all, let me start by thanking you very much for your hospitality. As a former student of Sciences Po, it is a privilege to be here with what will soon be some sort of a sister company, because I understand that there are agreements underway in various segments of the teaching between our two schools. I'm very honoured to be invited to speak at this very moment for all sorts of reasons, as you can imagine, but particularly because this European series, as I understand, will have Lord Patton very shortly, whose track record in these matters is impeccable and sets extremely high standards for me, so I'll do my best. It is also indeed very timely because we all believe that more creative and more effective thinking and more discussions are clearly needed to shape the Europe that we want to build for the 21st century and to make sure that the tall ship Europe stays afloat, continues the journey and arrives at a destination and continues the journey and arrives at destination. For a member of the French government, it is clearly challenging at this very moment to speak on both international trade and Europe at a time which is difficult for the European construction and for globalization, as it is called. We would call it mondialisation. While I decided nonetheless to take up the gauntlet, I would ask for your very kind hospitality and your protection under the law of hospitality, in exchange for which I promise that I will try not to be patronizing. French are often accused of being so patronizing, so that we then have an actual debate. Now today what I would like to do is to offer you my vision of Europe's role, and particularly that of our two nations, in the current round of the WTO negotiations. Because I believe that Europe can provide a unique and decisive contribution to the international trade debate, which can help unleash Doha's potential for better prosperity for all. Now, what I'd like to do, first of all, is say a few words about Europe, and if I may, fight off a few preconceived ideas or clichés that are circulated and that tend to spread around and have a life of their own. Before I do that, I would like to emphasize what actually our two countries, France and the UK, have in common in the context of the European Union. Because again, too many clichés, too many preconceived and poorly conceived ideas are circulated. And then I would like to move to actually where European values, European principles can inspire and tailor the Doha round and the continuation of discussions and negotiations. And starting with what is the EU actually at a time when it's complicated and difficult and where more innovative, more creative, more effective thinking is needed. We must understand what value it brings and what makes it so special in the global arena. Concerns about European construction raised by the citizens of France, the citizens of the Netherlands, and the current debate on the borders of Europe give the impression that Europe is a hotbed of dissension. Now, some countries are particularly happy that actually those dissensions stopped at the time of two referendums and did not have to go too much further. The press eagerly headlines our dispute on the common agricultural policy, on the budget, on the constitution, on what should be there, should not be there, but it rarely mentions our common values and our basic principles. Now, a full description of what Europe is about and what a singular player it is in our world and what a funny, strange political animal it has evolved in is clearly beyond the scope of this lecture. Like Alice trying to see how deep the rabbit hole was, we could wind our way through dozens of lectures on this issue. But I would like to just remind ourselves of a few facts. First of all, Europe is visible and is clearly visible and much more so probably from overseas than from within. As you mentioned, I was very active in private life, and as chairman of Baker McKenzie, which is a very, very large law firm around the world, I had to travel quite extensively. And I'm pretty sure that if you ask an African, an American, or an Asian what he or she thinks a European is, he or she will have a much clearer view and a much clearer picture than if you ask a Spaniard, a Brit, or a French. Because from the outside, you concentrate on what we have in common, whereas from within, we tend to concentrate on what our differences are. And if we ask those American, Africans, or Asians, they will probably come up with human rights, the welfare state, freedom of expression, common culture, and possibly history, not to mention those who believe that we are old in some fashion. Second, people tend to underestimate the essential values that we share. We don't need to go back to the Entente Cordiale, back under the people that 100 years ago actually decided, 101 year ago, decided that we had a lot in common. But we clearly have a lot in common, a long history, including the taste of victory and the bitterness of defeat. But our bilateral relationships are deeply rooted in that shared history. This common ground made it possible yesterday to contemplate what today would seem pure fiction, the union of our two countries on many, many topics. We all remember, well, maybe not all of us, but we have read, we have been taught, and we all remember as a result, that Churchill and his cabinet, with an exceptional sense of generosity at the time, accepted Jean Monnet's proposal of a Franco-British Union in response to France's dramatic defeat in June 1940. We have more in common than what separates us. And I would like to just mention four areas where clearly France and the United Kingdom are demonstrating common interest and laying the ground for better understanding and making it available to the rest of the world where it helps. Those four points that I would like to briefly mention are, first of all, our determination to act as a global player. Second, our commitment to eradicate poverty. Third, our commitment to environment protection. And fourth, our welfare state. Number one, our determination to act as a global player. If you look around the world, there are very, very few countries today that have developed the capacity to act as a global player with a whole range of policy and tools, including military action, diplomacy, influence, and a focus on development. Even fewer countries have developed that capacity in a manner and with the goals that are used by the United Kingdom and France. Okay, let's look at the how. We both learned during our long history that time and space play a very important role in geopolitics. We know that geopolitics and diplomatic issues have to be considered over the long term and in all their complexity, and we know that crisis management, without regard for the past or for the future, is the best way to get it wrong. We can see this clearly in the approach that is being followed by the United Kingdom and by France, as well as a couple of other countries, on the Iranian issue. The same is true for trade policy. We both know that simplistic approach are wrong and that transition periods are critically important. Let's look at the why. Both the United Kingdom and France put their status as global players at the service of greater cause. Well, they do so in the interest of peace, in the interest of protection and defense of human rights. And this is why French and British soldiers are combating on the same battlefield, whether it's in Yugoslavia or Afghanistan. You will have noted that I've not mentioned Iraq, and of course there are areas where we don't necessarily agree. Joint projects in the area of defense are also numerous, and I would like to mention just two of them. One is the French-British agreement that was signed in Saint-Malo back in 1998, which was seminal to the launch of the European defense. And second, the decision recently made to build an aircraft carrier under a joint industrial project. This is for our determination to act as global player. Let's look now at our commitment to eradicate poverty. The United Kingdom and France undoubtedly feel responsible for the development of poor countries, particularly African countries. And this special interest does not only emanate from our head of states that have made it their priority, it is shared by our people, and it is seen regularly in charities, in movements to raise solidarity, as, for instance, the recent movement led by Bono. Almost every G8 meeting expresses the commitment of our two nations to the developing country, with a clear focus on Africa since 2004. For instance, France is determined to increase its official development projects and its assistance to 0.5% of GDP by 2007 and to 0.7% in 2012. In many development projects, France and the United Kingdom go hand in hand. The British proposal, for instance, to create the International Financing Facility as a vehicle for raising additional funds was supported by France. Conversely, the United Kingdom has supported the French initiative for a voluntary contribution on airline tickets, much to the regret of some of our national carriers. This sense of solidarity with developing countries stems primarily from our past, but is also deeply rooted in deep layers of our vision for mankind and man's relationship with the world, going back to something that we also have in common, the Enlightenment of the 18th century. This explains why the United Kingdom and France spend considerable time, money, and political capital to help reduce poverty, to promote good governance, as well as to combat AIDS and other diseases, sometimes to the detriment of our very industry. Third example, our commitment to environment protection. That third example is the awareness that our environment is endangered and needs to be protected. Both countries are playing a leading role in international discussions, from forestry protection to climate change to hazardous waste. The influence of energy of our two countries were critical in including sustainable development in international discussions, first in Rio in 1992 and subsequently in Johannesburg at the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And more recently, the United Kingdom received the full support of France on climate change within the context of the G8. Fourth example, which is probably not as easy, relates to the welfare state. Now, this is an area where clearly there are divergences and there are tensions between the United Kingdom and France. Clearly, we have our own vision, and the balance, as far as the balance between trade dealt with by state and where the market has to play a leading role, divergence on the roles of competition and public service. But the more fundamental need to address the trade-off between efficiency and fairness, between responsibility and tolerance, is not called into question and is clearly represented in the welfare state. Obviously, the cursor may be placed further out, further in, and I guess this is not something new for the London School of Economics experts, who have been playing a key role in the establishment of a welfare state in Britain during the last century, providing some of the best and most famous reference works, such as the Beveridge Report and more recently The Watershed Third Way by Anthony Giddens. Now, United States and France, for which I've selected those four particular topics as examples of where we have a lot in common, are no exception on the European landscape. European values and collective choices have an impact on the EU approach to external trade policy. And I would like to state some of those values and principles that can actually be used to tailor a better Doha development round. First of all, I believe that Europe's long and recent history has taught us a few lessons about hegemony. Europe is perceived now as acting as a soft power, not only by necessity, but because it has learned from experience that developing a non-hegemonic global system is a less inefficient way to promote, maybe it is the best efficient way, but certainly the less inefficient way to promote long-term economic growth and global stability. This culture of global relations based on global governance and rules with shared responsibility and power explains why Europe is one of the prime advocates of multilateralism, consensus-based decision-making, cultural diversity, and human rights. Trade is not an exception. As you know, Europe fought very hard to set up the WTO and to add to it an effective dispute resolution system. This was certainly not the first choice of many developed countries. Global rules are also prerequisite to ensure that all countries, even the poorest, have and can use the same right. Global rules protect developing countries. And I would like to here pause for a second to quote somebody that I highly respect when it comes to identifying what is world regulation all about. His name is Lacordaire, a Dominican from the 19th century, a very, very wise and enlightened man, who said something like, and this is an English translation, so I'll be happy to quote him in French. It comes much easier for me. But in English translation, it's essentially between the poor and the rich, the weak and the powerful, liberty and slaves, and the law sets free. So to those that complain about the effect of globalization and how it does not support some of the developing countries, I would point to the direction of Mr. Lacordaire. Entre le riche et le pauvre, entre le faible et le fort, la liberté opprime et la loi libère. Europe firmly believes that developing countries... I was only giving you the French translation for the English translation that I was just giving you earlier on. Now, Europe firmly believes that developing countries need global rules, not to defend themselves so much, but to re-up the benefits of globalization and to be protected from possible attempts by more powerful countries or multinational enterprises to try to negotiate their own deals at their own terms. Accordingly, in trade negotiations, Europe definitely gives priority to multilateral over bilateral agreements. Multilateral agreements, we believe, deliver much larger economic benefits and permit the global rules needed to ensure fair and equitable trade. In this respect, and here I'm assuming that you have a fairly good knowledge of WTO issues, the abandonment of three of the four Singapore issues was, and still is, a cruel setback for Europe's vision of the current round of negotiations. So recent history has told us that hegemony is not the best route and that multilateralism is a much better approach, one that should be supported and one that actually protects developing countries. Secondly, Europe is genuinely committed, just like France and the UK, as mentioned earlier, is genuinely committed to eradicating global poverty around the world. I just want to remind you that without constant pressure from Europe, the current Global Compact for Development, which combines the Millennium Development Goals, the Monterey Consensus, the Doha Development Arrangement, and the World Summit for Sustainable Development, would not have emerged with the same strength as it did. All areas of Europe's external relation policies are concerned by this determination to combat poverty. Europe has a clear leadership in the area of assistance and cooperation. It is the largest international aid donor with 55% of global overseas development assistance, that is over $40 billion in 2004. And recently, the EU member states took the historical decision to double development assistance to $80 billion by 2010. Globalization has undoubtedly created massive wealth, but it has also created huge inequalities between those who benefit and those who fear globalization. Looking at the creation of wealth, GDP in the 30 most developed countries has increased tenfold during the last 30 years. 30 countries, 30 years, GDP increased by tenfold. Yet today, more than 1 billion people live below poverty level with less than $1 a day. So if trade is part of the problem, trade has to also be part of the solution. And indeed, trade can be a very powerful engine for development. In low-income countries, openness to international trade is a key asset for rapid economic growth, as demonstrated by the dazzling growth in China. Taking China as an example, and I know that it is only one example out of so many others that would not be as evident, but need to be inspired by the example of China. While in 1990, there were roughly 375 million people living in extreme poverty in China, if current trends continue, only 16 million of them will remain poor in 2015. Now, this evolution affects China, but it also reflects a wider economic integration within Eastern Asia, which has lifted more than altogether 400 million people out of poverty. Since 1999, Europe has been pushing very hard to make development the focus of the new round, and it decisively helped ensure a strong link between market access and rules in the Doha Development Agenda in order to boost international trade and promote economic growth in poor countries. Third value and principle where Europe is together and where certainly it can help tailor the Doha round, Europe initiated and mainstreamed the concept of sustainable development in its entire range of policies. Yes, we can do better, of course, but certainly we've initiated the process. Preaching the converts, I suppose, this sustainable development movement is understood to mean that both developed and developing countries pursue strategies aimed at non-inflationary growth while preserving environmental resources and promoting social equity. In Europe, and I'm not only talking about continental Europe, in the whole of Europe, the environmental dimension is particularly sensitive, notably because of our physical limitations compared with, for instance, the United States. Lack of physical space, a high population density, pollution linked to a relatively long history of industrialization. What does sustainable development mean in the context of international trade policy? Essentially, it means that trade liberalization is not an end in and of itself. It should simultaneously achieve environmental, social, and economic objectives, not only trade. And sustainable development means making sure that trade policy supports poverty eradication policies, that developing countries can export without unfair barriers, and that international trade rules go hand in hand with environmental protection at national, regional, and global levels. More concretely, Europe has strongly pushed for the recognition of sustainable development in the DDA. DDA is the Doha Development Agreement, under Article 6, and to include environmental concerns in the negotiations, such as the full liberalization of environmental goods. Fourthly, and I'll come to the end of my European principles that can help tailor better WTO negotiations, Europe firmly believes in a market economy as well as in a welfare state. This means that the state has the duty to strike a balance between gains resulting from competition and gains resulting from social justice. Now, worldwide, this concept is far from obvious. In both developed and developing countries, globalization has had a strong impact on our capacity to achieve such a balance. The welfare system is currently challenged by those who think that no regulations should exist beyond the rules of the market, and by those who consider it as an obstacle to competitiveness in a perfectly globalized world. Apart from the economic argument, and here I'm on much weaker grounds, you are at home here, I would like to stress the political need that all governments have at the moment to reassure citizens of Europe that a genuine system allowing for a fair share of economic benefits is actually possible in the context of a globalized world. From France's perspective, this is essential to ensure the political and social acceptability of trade liberalization. Indeed, the need to liberalize markets is neither obvious nor consensual, as is clearly illustrated by general, occasional, but strong opposition to globalization. In 2003, a European survey on globalization showed that while a majority of Europeans is supporting globalization, a large fraction of European citizens are worried that globalization will threaten their standards of living. In France, I think it is fair to say that globalization fears have fueled the no vote on May the 29th. They reflect the fear that globalization may affect the power of the national state to regulate and to adopt rules that will apply domestically. The at home versus the rest of the world is a rising sentiment. These fears also reflected the perceived consequences of trade liberalizations. Many of these fears focus on the visible part of the iceberg, the outward, mainly negative effects that globalization can have or is seen to have. And they fail to analyze what is less obvious, which includes the various opportunities of trade liberalization, better competition, economic growth that is sustainable, innovation, development of new services, better use of natural resources, and reduction, let alone, hopefully, elimination of poverty. Now, European politicians have to deal with these concerns, which are both genuine and legitimate, and what we need to do is to design a trade policy that is fully compatible with the European model and the values that I have discussed earlier. Now, having now tried to not only put you to sleep deeply, but to identify the principles that are at the heart of Europe and that can actually tailor the WTO round in a direction that is more favorable to all of us and particularly to the developing countries, I will now address the question of how Europe can actually be active in helping to seize the opportunities created by trade talks. And I've called that chapter, Can EU Help Save Private Doha? What I would like to do is go through with you where we are at the moment, then examine what the objectives are in our view, and then say a few words about the tactics and the strategy that we could adopt before I conclude and give you the floor. The DDA, if you don't mind, I will use the abbreviation, although I'm not fond of those abbreviations, but this one is the only one that I will use. The DDA is halfway through two successes, one failure. Major successes, Doha in 2001, Geneva in 2004. Debated occasionally, but certainly analyzed in retrospect as success. And one big failure that you all remember, which is Cancun in 2003. And the round is now at a crucial stage for completion, hopefully. And as Peter Mandelson said recently, states should move from standoff to trade-off. And there is a sense of realism and urgency in this call for momentum, since these negotiations, which were initially launched as a four-year round starting in 2001, well, guess what? We're a little bit behind schedule. Need to be completed in 2006 for reasons that I'll be happy to expand on, but which have to do with the calendar of Congress in the United States in particular. So where are we 4 years after the launch of the DDA? Two salient elements. Number one, the scope of the DDA has been reduced since its inception, and three out of the four Singapore issues have been eliminated. Point number two, the negotiations are currently marked by an imbalance of the parties' commitments with respect to the different issues on the table. Some negotiations have progressed, such as agriculture in particular, but others, such as services, such as industrial products, have stalled. After the framework agreement, which was back in July 2004, discussions failed to reach a momentum until very recently, despite the leadership evidenced by Europe, which made a significant concession back in 2004 on export support. Now, the lack of demonstrated commitment by other developed countries, such as the United States, until a week ago. Let's not forget, a week ago, there was no move. It was completely flat. And the lack of energy demonstrated by the G20 countries and the G90 countries certainly contributed to this very, very slow process until, as I said, a week ago, where suddenly things started moving. And we can come back on that. One of the striking elements of the discussions in recent months was confirmation of the strength of the G20 alliance and its role as a deal maker in the negotiations. the nature of this fairly heterogeneous group, in which Brazil is pushing for liberalization of the agricultural markets, while India endeavors to maintain some protection, is favorable to moderate and non-radical negotiation positions, as we have recently seen. And the leadership evidenced by the G20 countries is clearly one of the key factors that we can take out as a potential factor of success for the round. Another lesson from what has happened in the last 4 years is the relatively weak capacity of the US-EU duet. Here comes the synchronized swimming, you see, to generate actual momentum. The dance can no longer be led by these two major partners. And clearly, the quartet of the US, the EU, Brazil, and India seems much better suited to prepare the ground for broader discussions. Now, Hong Kong is not the end of the round, but it is definitely a critical stage. And 8 weeks before Hong Kong is due to start, the clock is ticking. And both success and failure are possible. What is certain, though, is that the level of discussion should be raised to match the ambitions of member states. All right, what are the objectives? And let's make no mistake, what Europe wants, certainly what France wants, is success, not failure. In order to make Hong Kong a success, the momentum needs to be boosted, and the need to scale up and speed up discussions is urgent in order to seize the opportunities presented by this year of negotiation. Europe's leadership and influence will be key to ensuring that the negotiations go in the right direction of a balanced and ambitious agreement reflecting the spirit of Doha and Europe's values as I outlined them for you. In order to promote the liberalization of markets, harness globalization by equitable and fair rules, and ensuring, most importantly, the integration of developing countries in the world trade. To do so, in our view, Europe needs to show determination in the following areas. Number one, the Doha round should be about development. 5 years on, progress towards the Millennium Development Goal is falling pretty short of its targets, particularly in the poorest of the poorest area of the world, the sub-Saharan Africa. The latest global monitoring report by the World Bank and the IMF calls for greater momentum in a number of areas, including realizing the development promise of trade. It says that the adoption of an ambitious liberalization agenda in the WTO Doha round of trade negotiations would help achieve the goals by 2015. I'm quoting them. Trade will not be sufficient, and we know that, to pull developing countries out of poverty, but it will certainly make an important contribution. And in this respect, the DDA offers opportunity to further integrate developing countries in the world economy, thanks to market opening and better rules. Too often, trade negotiations are seen and depicted as a north-south dialogue and a north-south issues, while developing countries have a lot to win from south-south integration. The examples of Asia that I referred to earlier on, but also the example of Latin America, whose economies are reaping some of the benefits from their integration and intra-regional trade, are clear demonstrations of the benefit of the south-south trade. For the poorest countries, and for Africa in particular, the problem is indeed less to know how to protect themselves from world trade than to reap the benefit from enhanced south-south trade. And in this regard, two parameters are very important. One is time, and the other is differential treatment. Developing countries should be granted the luxury and the privilege of time, more time for them for transition, and the benefit of much lower tariffs, if at all. In this round, we need quick progress on all issues that which are important for developing and least developed countries. The negotiations on special and differentiated treatment for the developing countries have stalled. The situation with regard to cotton has remained unchanged since Cancun, and we all know that at the Cancun conference, that was a very, very hot and critical issue. And the issue of eroding tariff preferences has barely been addressed. Finally, the transposition of the August 30th agreement on poor countries' access to medicine into the TRIPS agreement has yet to be achieved in most countries. Here I think that Europe can actually lead the charge or lead the change and seek real progress in Hong Kong on three specific areas where we can demonstrate leadership. One is access to medicine. Now, I know that there are controversial views, and I know that not everybody shares the view that the 2003 agreement should be pursued, developed, and implemented into legislation. Let's just keep in mind that every week in the developing world, 200,000 children under 5 years of age die of disease. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, 2 million people will die of AIDS this year. The DDA is an opportunity to give a definitive legal framework that would allow the poorest countries, which do not have manufacturing capabilities, to have access to affordable medicine. The EU strongly supports an agreement before or in Hong Kong. It would be a key deliverable, confirming the commitment of the international community to facilitate access to medicine for the poorest. I know it's controversial. I know some NGOs are not convinced that this will work. This is what we have, and what we believe is that we should move on with that. That's a first step. Second area where Europe can show leadership and clearly lead the charge and lead the change, the problem of cotton has to be addressed. Today, the world's cheapest cotton is produced in West Africa in small-scale farms. Yet, those farmers cannot sell their production because the United States, one of the major cotton exporters, subsidizes its own production, whereas in the EU, we decided to include cotton in the reform package that was put together in 2003. This means that trade-distorting subsidies are no longer used by Europe. The DDA is the opportunity and the time to find a sustainable solution to this important issue for Africa. The EU is leading the way. France has been playing a very important role. Now, obviously, trade is not enough and should not be the exclusive and the sole focus. But clearly, it is a key issue. We saw it in Cancun. Our French president launched the Cotton Initiative in order to respond quickly to the needs of African producers. More than €67 million has been earmarked by France for this purpose only. Third area where Europe can lead the change, lead the charge. The issue of erosion of preference must be addressed, and least developed countries should be granted duty-free access to developed countries. The general dismantlement of tariffs consecutive to the DDA will significantly erode the preferential tariffs that developing countries and the least developed countries enjoy for the moment. Significant aids should be provided to compensate this loss. The developed world has also to make concrete trade arrangements such as the multilateralization of the Everything But Arms initiative that was launched by Europe. The complete opening of the markets of developed countries to the least developed countries and the implementation of a free round to least developed countries would genuinely respond to the specific needs of those countries. This is a third possible deliverable for Hong Kong. Now, before closing the development chapter, I would like to stress the need to improve coordination between trade measure and cooperation and assistance. While it is not for the WTO to solve the question of aid, aid for trade. Discussions at the WTO should seek to facilitate coordination and promote synergies between those programs and the WTO round of discussions. Second area where Europe can be active and demonstrate its strength and its power of propositions. Europe needs to actively promote sustainable growth and employment at home. The DDA negotiations in services, in NAMA, non-agricultural products, and rules can raise the productivity of European businesses in two sorts of ways. Number one, by ensuring favorable conditions for European businesses, thanks to the supply of less expensive intermediate goods that are incorporated in the manufacturing process. That's number one. Number two, adopting trade rules that are designed to ensure a fair access to the market, to many markets, because it would broaden access to the growing markets of other developed and soon to be emerging countries, and as a result, create new markets for our businesses while reserving a way and a time for those developing countries to themselves build their strength in industry and services. This area of the negotiation still suffers from a worrying lack of ambition. There is little hope of seeing negotiations on industrial tariffs culminate in an ambitious opening up of the markets, especially those of the large developed countries and the large emerging countries, and in actual consolidation of rights. As to services, commitments at the moment go no further than the results of the previous round, be it in terms of number or actual quality of offers. The new dynamic that has just recently been introduced may be good, but it probably will not be enough to inspire a sector in which the Union has major offensive interests. Finally, the imbalance between market access and the rules is obvious and will be difficult to correct. This applies especially to anti-dumping and indication of geographical origins that are major concerns for the Union. Yet the gains from trade liberalisation for our countries, for our economies, are huge. Our businesses face very high tariffs from certain emerging countries that are very, very emerged on occasions. For instance, 100% tariffs apply to our wine in India, 30% tariffs on ceramics in the United States, 15% tariffs for steel in Brazil, while the average European market tariffs is at about 4%. Now, I mentioned growth and I mentioned employment. The link between the two is pretty obvious. The CEPII of French Economic Institutes estimates that liberalization in the machine tool sector alone would generate 525,000 new jobs in Europe. They might be a little bit off by 10,000 here or there, but that's a very sizable number. The gains would be even more significant in such service sectors as maritime transportation, distribution, environmental services, construction, financial and insurance services. Services for both the UK and France and quite a few European Union countries account for 70% of our economies. And the levels of protection are far higher than for goods. And if we try to quantify the barriers to free services around the world, it is the equivalent of a 50% when expressed in tariff equivalent. Third and finally, Europe's value should be protected. As I said earlier, Europe believes that trade liberalization is not an end in and of itself. Trade liberalization should respect and preserve the collective values that we've discussed earlier, or preferences rooted in social needs, or collective choices made by countries. It is about cultural diversity. It is about safeguard of public service. And it is about, guess what? Agriculture. You are certainly aware that France is particularly sensitive to all those sectors. The promotion of cultural diversity is part of the collective preferences to which French, British, and all other European citizens are keenly attached. This is why Europe continues to advocate preservation of cultural diversity, and while we continue to demand exclusion of the audiovisual sectors from liberalization of services. The positive outcome of the UNESCO negotiations on the Convention for Cultural Diversity was strongly backed by Europe and many other countries, if I may say. And it will make it easier to promote cultural diversity and to limit the emergence of a possible conflict with WTO rules. Public services should be preserved. The DDA should not prohibit the right to reserve public services activity for public enterprises to entrust them to private monopolies with public service concessions, provided, of course, that there is strict and straight compliance with WTO principles. Now, I'm sure some of you are eager to hear me say what I want to say on agriculture, which remains a key issue of these negotiations. It is not surprising, because what is at stake is not the share of agriculture in trade. It only represents about 12% of trade. But it represents the day-to-day life of millions of people in the world. Not just talking about the European Union here, I'm talking about the world. And it matters both from a strategic and cultural point of view in many parts of the world again, not only in Europe, but in many other sections, in many other quarters. This is no surprise if we see that India, for instance, is very close to the views expressed and put together by Europe. Now, among WTO nations, Europe has an important role to play in these agricultural negotiations, because we can demonstrate that it is possible to actually develop an agricultural system without damaging the poorest countries. Now, to do so, we have to speak clearly on three issues. Number one, agriculture is not an economic sector like any industrial sector, such as steel or textile. Agriculture policy is based on strategic choices tied to rural development, tied to food security, tied to the environment, tied to sustainable growth. I'm sure that some of you, I might actually ask you, for instance, how many of you have spent time holidaying in France? Please raise your hand.
You'd be better asking who hasn't.
I was just going to do that, actually. Well, this is, if I may say, globalization in action, by the way. You know, 30 years ago, when I was a little kid, there were not that many people that were spending their holiday in the UK. Not sure what and how many hands would... Sorry, skip that. But I'm sure that all those of you that have spent time holidaying in France or have spent time holidaying in Spain or Italy would be utterly disappointed if suddenly this nicely laid out farming areas with all their activities and crops, harvesting, we've just finished the wine harvesting season, were replaced by vacant land and random trees here and there. This is one of the strategic aspects of the agricultural common policy. And the point is not to discuss the legitimacy of policy objectives that seek to support agriculture, but we have to ensure that that policy to which all of us are attached to is not going to distort much and not damage trade for the poorest countries. Now, some don't know what press you all are reading, but I'm reading some media on occasions, or watching some television channels, or listening to some radio channels, that tend to believe, or try to convince you, that European agriculture remains a huge problem. Now, the reality is quite different. Agriculture is a complex area, and we should all avoid simplistic approach. Now let me just take up three points that I regard as myths and that I would like to vehemently, vigorously argue. First myth: Europe is a closed market for agricultural products. Wrong. Europe is the world's largest importer, $60 billion back in 2001. I don't have more recent figures, but I will check them for you. It imports more than the US, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada combined, absorbing 85% of Africa's agricultural export. Okay, some will say, fine, this is proximity for you. No way. And 45% of Latin America's production. Now, we're no longer talking proximity here. Of all industrialized countries, the EU gives by far the highest level of preferential access to developing countries. And the average tariff is close to 11% in the case of preferential treatment. Moreover, our Everything But Arms initiative gives the 49 least developed countries duty and quota-free access to the European Union. So to anybody who says to you, Europe is a closed market for agricultural products, no, this is not the case. Second myth: Europe is the champion of trade distorting support. Partly wrong. Europe earmarks a larger budget for supporting agriculture than the United States, for instance, which is also a champion. But the per capita support per farmer is far lower than that in the United States. If you measure on a per capita account, the United States spend $20,000 per farmer, while we spend $14,000 per farmer. Of course, they have fewer farmers, and we have a lot of them. But on a per capita calculation, the United States do spend more money on their farmers. Third myth: the agricultural policy of developed countries worsens poverty. Not necessarily. If developed countries were to eliminate all forms of agricultural support, worldwide prices of agricultural products at the moment would increase, sometimes very, very steeply. The DDA, it is calculated, could thus generate an increase of 18% in wheat prices alone. Now, this situation would be pretty traumatic for the least developed countries. They are all net food importers whose food bill would automatically increase massively. Furthermore, when it comes to Europe, the Common Agricultural Policy reform of 2003 will dramatically reduce trade-distorting subsidies as we walk into the implementation by decoupling support measure from production. That's what some people call moving from one box to the other, for those of you who are familiar with this box game or categorization. Europe is clearly committed in the field of agriculture to reducing internal subsidies and lowering tariff barriers. And the commitment is not just rhetoric. It is also reflected in the concrete steps that have been taken since 1992, most recently in the reform of the Common Agricultural Policy back in 2003. The fact that this reform ensures significant leverage in the WTO negotiations does not mean that Europe will surrender to other developed countries or to Cairn countries which would like to use agriculture with exclusively a mercantile approach. Europe expects parallel commitments as regard export support and domestic subsidies, in particular from the United States and other developed countries. We regard the move of last week as moving in the direction of what we have achieved, the move by the United States of last week, which was nicely advertised in the Financial Times, as one move to match the effort that we put into place back in 2003 when the European Union member states decided to reform the Common Agricultural Policy. and the July 2004 acceptance of the principle of eliminating export subsidies has not particularly so far helped discipline our partners' subsidy schemes, their export credit of food aids, on which we have not received clear indication. The exporting countries are exerting strong pressure on market access. This is a particularly delicate subject for the Union, since it affects what we call the community preference, which is at the heart of the agricultural policy since the foundation of Europe. The agreement in July 2005 to use a more flexible version of the tariff reduction formula, the one that was proposed by the G20, is certainly a gesture, and a strong one, on the part of European Union. In this context, Europe in particular must pay attention to the combined effects. These things are not simple, straightforward, categorized black, white, one box, two box, three boxes. They have to be seen not in isolation, but they have to be examined with their combined effect. And clearly the combined effect of export support and tariff reductions could at some point, if not properly monitored within the parameters of the common agricultural policy, could threaten the common agricultural policy as we have agreed to modify it in 2003. Clearly, this should not be possible under the current mandate that the European Union has stipulated and which are clearly red lines that should not be crossed. Europe's determination to make this a balanced and ambitious round is important. It will not be sufficient to ensure the success in Hong Kong. Here I see four conditions, and I promise you I'm then moving to a very, very brief conclusion. The four conditions are the following. Number one, and I'll go through them very briefly. Other developed countries should really get engaged in agricultural discussions in a constructive, realistic, and detailed fashion. They should reform their agricultural policy with the same degree of ambition that we have demonstrated in 2003. Number two, emerging countries should accept differentiation amongst developing countries. For example, in the same category today, you find Ghana, $320 per inhabitant per year, and Brazil, GDP of $3,100 per head. Clearly, there is a differentiation and a limit to be drawn within the group of developing countries between the least developed and the very emerging countries. Three, developed countries should agree to solve some specific issues which I've mentioned earlier, the cotton market, access to medicine, the multilateralization of everything but arms, as well as pledges for trade, for aid package. And four, emerging countries should agree to open their market gradually but significantly to European products and services so that there is actual trade-off and an encouragement to move towards a point of equilibrium in the round. Few words about the tactics and method. How to ensure that Europe will be in the best position to promote its interests, its values, and its vision of trade development as I've tried to articulate it. This should rely on a clear negotiation tactic, a good coordination between EU member states and the Commission, as well as appropriate diplomacy. The EU should adopt an offensive position. Firstly, I think that Europe has been on the defensive foot on too many issues and for too long. It is not the best tactics, because if we adopt that tactic, then our partners will take us where they want, when they want it, and it is the worst solution for a soldier to be. As Europe wants to succeed with an ambitious and balanced result in Hong Kong, we should avoid bargaining too early in the negotiation process, for instance, between NAMA and agriculture. Second, there should be better coordination between member states and the negotiator. Carrying a negotiation is like driving a bus or driving a boat. The destination must be clear and clearly identified. The passengers should be seated comfortably in the back and should feel at ease if the pilot has to slightly change the course because they know that he's moving in the right direction within the parameters of the roadmap. This is particularly true for Tall Ship Europe. We have some fundamental questions linked to fundamental choices. I've referred to development, I've referred to public services, I've referred to cultural diversity, I've referred to agriculture. The EU negotiator is in a terribly difficult position, there's no question about it. He has to deal with 25 member states. He has to deal with 25 different agenda. And that's a difficult task. But he has to make sure that the passengers on the boat understand that the destination that they have agreed and the course of action that they have agreed and the roadmap that has been discussed is going to be respected. The only solution to manage this and to maintain the level of confidence is to set up specific modalities to ensure sufficient transparency between the negotiator and the member states. It should facilitate the work of the negotiator and clearly reinforce the weight and the voice of Europe. This is, of course, a topic that will be discussed tomorrow morning in Luxembourg. Finally, the dialogue with WTO members should be deepened. The success of the European vision, as I've tried to articulate it earlier, will depend on the capacity of Europe to share views and to dialogue with other WTO members. And given the pro-development orientation of our trade policy, developing countries should be our first choice. We have to better understand their issues, their need, their expectations. If we had taken more time to dialogue better with them in Cancun, well, maybe it would have been more successful in Cancun. And we wouldn't be having that lecture at the moment. As I mentioned earlier, the emergence of G20 as a solid, credible partner in the negotiation, one that is likely to operate as a deal broker, is a positive and should be preserved. Here I come to my conclusion. At last, they'll say. I believe that the DDA offers real opportunities to further promote political stability, sustainable growth, both in the developed and in the developing world. It is certainly not the last round. There will be more rounds to go. And in those more rounds to go, we will not be talking about tariffs much. We will probably be talking about rules. And rules will be far more sensitive, socially and politically. The clarification of the stakes that trade opening implies on our policy is certainly an important priority on which academics, and I'm turning over to you now, should help us on. We need more work. We need more empirical data. The work done by Martin Wolf was terrific. Why globalization work? Of course it works. But we need more work. And clearly the London School of Economics, together with Sciences Po, together with other schools around the world, will be critical in helping politicians, in helping those that try to have the courage to move our objectives further, will be needed. Being here at the London School of Economics, I cannot resist suggesting a few directions of work that may help us communicate better and assess future negotiations. We have to pay more attention and take better care of those who appear to be or perceive themselves as losers in the globalization. Societies are deeply fractured between those who benefit from liberalization and those who suffer from it. Those who benefit are in this room, most of them. They speak several languages, they travel the world, they use highly sophisticated technology devices. They feel confident. While the second group fears globalization, fears what China is going to do for the future, and feel that they might lose their job if they have one. So in order to better manage the transitional effects of trade opening, we need better tools to anticipate changes. we need to better assess specifically what the effects of liberalization will be on our societies. Without such tools, without using them in a timely fashion, we run the risk of antagonizing too many of those that have fear rather than confidence in what globalization can bring about. Second direction, and I will finish here, we have to design new policies and tools to enable us to open our market to stimulate growth while having the certainty that our core domestic choices, our culture and our preference can be better protected. We should not ever be imposed to import hormone beef. We should not be imposed to import genetically modified food if we do not want to. And as long as European citizens do not have the insurance that the global trade will not endanger their fundamental choices, WTO will often and still be regarded as a threat, and there is a risk that there is refusal of the entire system because we will not have conceived the special tools and techniques that will prevent such negative effect. The task is challenging, but it's also about empirical research. It's about facts. It's about truth. One often says that in war, the first casualty is the truth. Well, we're not at war. And as Montesquieu would say, trade actually liberates people. He said that back many, many years ago, centuries ago. We're not at war, and yet we need to stick to the truth. I will just leave you with an encouraging statement by Mr. Aristoteles, who used to say, "Seeking the truth is both difficult and easy. Difficult because you can never reach it, and easy because you cannot miss it completely." I guess that for economists of a school whose motto I understand is "Rerum cognoscere causas," the challenges I raise are just two more. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much to Madame Lagarde for such a wide-ranging and comprehensive review of trade issues. I'm sure Peter Mandelson will be pleased to hear that at least one person in among the trade ministers is sympathetic towards him. Now, unfortunately, as Madame Lagarde mentioned, she has to be in Luxembourg at the crack of dawn tomorrow, so I regret we have to interrupt the questions and answers. Or do we have
I
a couple of minutes?
I might be driving to be there on time.
We have 5 minutes, maybe? Okay, well, we have a few minutes then for a small number of questions. Start at the back here.
The global leader.
Could you tell us who you are? And short, very short questions.
Yeah, Mahesh Nagarajan. I work for a software company. I just want to ask you, as a global leader, what do you think is EU's roadmap for sustainable development in Africa? Briefly.
Sustainable development. I'll take three questions. Question right at the back up here.
Hello, my name is Varish Karapınar, doing a PhD at LSE. You have spoken throughout your speech. You have spoken on behalf of Europe, but I thought it was the job of European Union Trade Commissioner, not yours. And when it comes to agriculture, he has quite different views. He supports more open trade. He supports more open access, market access to developing countries, and he wants to lower the domestic subsidies. And obviously, the position of France is the most conservative on this. Could you speak on behalf of French farmer and tell us what is the position of France in Hong Kong when it comes to agriculture? Thank you.
Now, I'll take a third question up here, please, and then we'll do one round of answers, if that's all right.
Good evening. My name is Ségolène. I'm an international relations student here, but I'm also speaking on behalf of the 300 French and British students who will be meeting next week in Paris, discussing matters of corporate responsibility and international development. And linking to this, I was wondering, you've mentioned the benefits of responsible free trade in your speech several times. I was wondering if and how you were preparing the negotiations and carrying out the Doha agenda with those very French, in your case, multinational corporations. Thank you.
Right. answer some questions now.
In response to your point about sustainable growth and what it means for Africa, clearly the three criteria that I've identified that apply and actually define sustainable growth equally apply wherever growth is sought. But clearly there will be necessary adjustment when it comes to the African countries, particularly the sub-Saharan countries, where specific protection, specific timing, specific transition, and freer access is needed for their products in order to sustain, you know, their development at a more protected, if I may use that word, fashion, simply because of the level at which they are. You asked me about the... In my presentation, I clearly represented the views from France, and absolutely granted, in this WTO discussions, the views of the 25 member states are expressed by the agent of the 25 member states, and that is Commissioner for Trade Peter Mandelson. But he's clearly seeking the views of the 25 member states to be in a proper position to express those collective views. It is not something that a commissioner dictates to the member states. At the end of the day, the member states eventually decide which route they want to take and what the destination is, which is clearly what I've tried to express in my presentation. And if I did, on occasions, refer to Europe or make references to the Franco-British views, at least those that are common, of the world with reference to four specific principles, I've certainly done so because I believe that is to be the case. But as I expressed myself, I expressed the French view, and I was not pretending to engage on behalf of 25 member states. This would not be my role. As to your question, and I'm delighted to hear that you will all be meeting in Paris for this special convention or meeting that you have in the Hotel des Invalides, if I recall, right? Yeah, I've seen that. It's absolutely great. And this is also globalization. This is the exchange of views. This is students brainstorming on common ideas, and I really welcome that. I'm not sure I actually understood your question, because you referred to the specific problems that the French industry encounters, or I lost you. I apologize for that.
Not specifically. I was just wondering how, because you have mentioned free trade very much and the benefits of responsible free trade, how you, in your position as Minister for Foreign Trade in France, interacted with French, specifically French multinational corporations, because I assume you deal with them more, in terms of preparing the negotiations about the Doha agenda and then carrying out the Doha agenda.
Okay. Well, the consultation process that I tried to observe almost religiously includes consulting very regularly with the trade unions, and as you know, in France we have several trade unions that are regarded as representative unions. I also consult and inform religiously as well the non-governmental organizations, and there are quite a few of them as well, and I consult also with representatives in the business sector to understand, so that they understand and we understand each other's positions and agenda. I've also endeavored, because it's a highly technical domain and one that is populated with jargon, which sometimes makes it extremely complicated for laymen and laywomen to actually understand. But I've also endeavored to include in the consultation process and in the sort of educational process members of parliament, so that they can really relate all of this back to their constituencies, because I regard that as important. And finally, what I've also recently started doing was to actually participate in discussions of that nature. I try to make my speech a little bit briefer than I have on this occasion, and I apologize for the length of it, but I've also done that with many universities and grandes écoles in France, so that young people, those who are tomorrow's future, actually understand the challenges of WTO.
We take one more round of three questions, and that'll be all right. Let's start here.
Linda Corsha, geography student here. Congratulations on your well-crafted speech. So I have to say that I disagree with most of the things in it. You did say that that EU politicians have to deal with concerns and that trade policy should be compatible with EU values. However, the European offer on trade in services, the GATS offer, was tabled at the WTO between the two referenda, so it got absolutely no attention at all. It wasn't debated previously by parliaments or member state publics. It's gone in with no awareness of what is in that offer, including the Mode 4 offer, the offer to workers to 145 countries, for instance. Whatever you feel about that, I think that people should have been allowed to debate that, and member state parliaments should have been allowed to debate it. So that offer is on the table at the WTO with just about no awareness of it. So how that fits with being compatible with EU values when no one even knows what the offer is seems very strange.
May I very respectfully disagree with you, actually, because if I judge from the number of correspondence, claims, discussions, phone calls that I receive in relation to our service offer, certainly it has attracted the attention of French Parliament, of French unions, of French non-governmental organisations, particularly in relation to Mode 4, actually. And you know, I was very keen to underline and to explain that this Mode 4 movement of people chapter is vastly different from the directive that has been a debate for discussion before the referendum took place in France in back at the end of May. But certainly I can assure you that it has actually originated quite a lot of discussions, and it's alive in France.
What we are talking about, there's one question at the back there.
Last one.
Yeah, last question, I'm afraid.
Just one question about the...
Who are you?
Sorry, I'm Fazal. I used to study in Westminster, but I'm not studying anymore. Just one question about... just interested, I came here today. You talked about Britain and France and how great they are in eradicating poverty around the world and promoting development around the world. My question is why you find it so difficult as government of Britain and France to put aside 0.75 of your GDP for sub-Saharan Africa's countries and eradicating poverty, and it's been that figure has been there for about 20 years, I don't know how many years, but for a long time. But you find it extremely difficult to set aside that money. And my second question, you asked the audience whether they love to see the sceneries in France and Italy when they go there traveling. I think most of these people that are here, as you said, they're people that they're benefiting from globalization. But I would suggest that you ask the same question when you go to sub-Saharan Africa, because they're the one who bearing the terrible implication of subsidies that you provide to farmers, to your farmers in agriculture.
Well, there is a provocative question for you.
On the issue of the export subsidies that you rightly so are raising, I just point you in the direction of the offer that has been put on the table by the European Union back in 2004, that is still on the table, and that requests that other developed countries actually move in the same direction, make the same offer, which is to eliminate the export subsidies, which, as you're referring to, are hurting and damaging those countries. I did actually spend quite a bit of time in various South African countries, including the likes of Zimbabwe, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, that's where politicians have to be brave, because what needs to be done is to actually encourage public opinion into the idea that by helping others, they're helping themselves. Naturally, people are not necessarily philanthropists. They're not prepared. Let me just finish. Thank you. They're not naturally philanthropists. And if the most enlightened of particular groups are convinced that it is a necessity and a direction in which we have to move at a faster pace, it is not something that is easily understood, let alone pushed and supported by many, many people.
Okay, Madame, it falls to me once again to thank you for being so candid in your speech, for setting out in detail some of the difficulties of getting an agreed position across Europe, and to wish you bon voyage to Luxembourg. Thank you.
Thank you very much.